It should be considered a brick house. And that day, as she chopped, I caught a glimpse of her breasts jiggling as the sharp smell of green chilies tickled my nose. I remember feeling a quiver in my stomach, an almost sexual thrill. Later, when Kalyani had her first child, she would let me watch as she breastfed in the storeroom. In the kitchen, my grandmother wielded a large iron ladle, blackened over time and permanently greasy at the base of its long handle, which she used for frying black mustard seeds and other spices. For some reason, this was always called tempering in Indian recipes I read. First, she poured oil into the ladle, then held it over the stovetop flame. When the oil was good and hot, she added mustard seeds, dried red chilies, then curry leaves and a pounded powdered resin called asafoetida. The distinct smell of mustard seeds and asafoetida frying, along with that of curry leaves, is what distinguishes southern from northern Indian food to me. The popping seeds also act as a sort of low-tech timer to tell you when the spices are sufficiently roasted. At the first crackle and pop, my grandmother would whisk the ladle away and add the oil mixture to whatever dish she was making. We all knew to stay clear of that scalding hot ladle with its smoking contents. If we were particularly hungry and stalking her like vultures, we'd cut a wide path around her until she delivered those spices to a pot of food. The familiar hushed sizzle, like the sound of a hot pan placed in a sink full of water, meant it was about time to eat. This ritual would immediately precede the serving of many dishes, such as rasam, a thin soup made with tamarind and tomato, sambar, a soupy lentil stew, or, my favorite, thayir sadam, a cool savory porridge of salted yogurt and rice. Thayir sadam is the ultimate South Indian comfort food. The anytime treat costs pennies to make and fills you up, thanks to a healthy combo of protein and carbs. It would be ladled into our lunchboxes during the winter months. In the hot season, it would be dinner, eaten after we returned home, sweaty from playing down the lane. Every housewife has her own special concoction that she mixed into yogurt rice. My mom fried freshly minced ginger and green chilies. My aunt added fresh pomegranate seeds and chopped cilantro, and others served it plain with just a spoonful of fiery Indian pickles made from green mango, sorrel, or lime. Few versions were anything but comforting and delightful, though my grandmother had the magic touch. With the contents of her iron ladle, mustard seeds and the like, plus perhaps crunchy fried lentils or even pieces of lotus root cured with spices, dried in the sun and brought over from my grandfather's village, Palagat, in Kerala, she would turn rice and yogurt into a meal that half a dozen kids would greedily lick from their cupped fingers. You'd smell the spices frying or hear the mustard seeds popping and know, T-minus a few minutes, thayir sadam. When there was plenty of yogurt, the dish was creamy and thick. When there wasn't, and she stretched the yogurt with milk and water, it was liquidy and thin. In India, yogurt is almost always homemade. It's easy, really. My aunts would boil milk, raw and unhomogenized milk, let it cool to room temperature, and add a bit of yesterday's yogurt, the starter reserved for this purpose. They'd cover the mixture and let it sit overnight until the cultures did their work and the milk soured and thickened. Because each batch of new yogurt contains some of yesterday's yogurt, and because this process happens daily for many years, yesterday is a sort of misnomer. The yogurt used to start each new batch is, in essence, many years old itself and becomes a kind of family property. Young brides, for instance, will take a spoonful of their mother's yogurt into their marital home. It's a lot like bread starter or yeast in the Pacific Northwest. My grandmother would set her yogurt in a, quote, quiet part of the kitchen. As my culinary universe expanded, I assumed that this quiet suggested some delicate process at work, one similar to the rising of a souffle, which French chefs semi-jokingly request that you do not disturb by talking while it is in the oven. Yet now I'm sure she meant quiet, as in a place where none of us kids would disturb it with our jostling and shoving. I was the worst, she tells me. I would routinely knock over the yogurt as I climbed up to reach for pickle jars above the counter. To keep it safe, she moved it farther back into the darker part of the kitchen counter. I assumed that the darkness also somehow assisted in this yogurt-making process, but it was really just about keeping the yogurt safe. You see, there were lizards lurking in the dark, and I was scared of them. Or, as my grandmother says, those lizards were quietly guarding the curds for me. Her strategy might have kept me away from the yogurt, but I still spent plenty of time in the kitchen and the attached storeroom where larger amounts of surplus pickles were kept. On the top pantry shelf, just above the jute sacks of rice and lentils and drums of sliced dried lotus root, was a row of glass jars containing a deliriously tempting array of pickles. In the kitchen, there were just a few varieties, but here they taunted me with their number. There were green mango pickles, lime pickles, and ginger pickles. There were pickles made from young jackfruit, sorrel, tamarind, gooseberry, and red chilies stuffed with cumin and fennel seeds. These Indian pickles were much more complex than the vinegary pickled vegetables in the West. They were pickled in mustard oil or sesame oil, with fenugreek and all sorts of spices mixed in a certain order in a certain proportion that changed with the whim and preference of my grandmother. When relatives came from Kerala or Tanjore or my uncle Ravi visited from Delhi, we were brought pickles from other regions my grandparents maintained a hankering for. I couldn't resist their siren song, and once, in the quiet of the afternoon, I set out to make them mine, with disastrous results. I was a good climber, still too small to be burdened by my weight, so up I went, from shelf to shelf, like a temple monkey. When I was close enough, I stretched to grab a jar, and, slick with oil, it slipped from my grasp and shattered. Glass and turmeric yellow oil were everywhere. Too afraid to call out and summon my angry Aunt Banu, too afraid of the broken glass to descend, I froze there, hanging onto the ledge for what seemed like 10 minutes before Neela opened the door and rescued me. In the summer, as long as the yogurt survived our rambunctiousness, we would often gather around Rajima on the cool marble floor in a semicircle, and she'd place in front of each of us a little steel bowl called a katori. She presided over a large steel bowl filled with leftover rice from the big brass pot that was always on the stove. She would mix cool yogurt into the rice with her right hand while turning the bowl with her left. I can still hear its tinny scrape against the marble floor. Banu would bring the iron ladle, bend down, and pour in the oil mixture as Rajima continued to mix. She would then take turns dropping wet dollops of rice into our upturned and outstretched hands. If you hadn't eaten your portion by the time she came around to you again, she'd place the next dollop in your bowl. If you let these pile up, the older kids like Neela or Vidya would snatch your bowl and empty it into their mouths right under your nose. As we ate, she told us stories and fables, the story of the sparrow and the king, tales of mischievous Lord Krishna, who as a child stole butter, pulled girls' braids, and bit every apple on a tree only once, wasting the fruit for everyone else. And my favorite, the fable of the cunning mina bird, who laid its eggs in a crow's nest while the crow was away hunting. Because mina bird eggs and crow's eggs looked exactly the same, the crow would be none the wiser. And while the poor crow sat dutifully on the eggs until they hatched, and then cared for the chicks as its own, the mina enjoyed itself, flying in the moonlight and singing in the trees. Once the mina chicks were old enough to fly and be recognized as imposters, they'd leave and join their parents for a carefree life. In the courtyard of our complex, there was a big, flat-leaf tree with white trumpet flowers that shaded all the flats. From our veranda, Neela and Rajini and Rohit and I would gaze at the crow's nests in the tree. Over the years, we watched many generations of crows hatch and grow. We'd watch many minor birds perch and sing. I'd often stake out one of the nests, waiting to catch a sneaky mina laying her eggs. Every summer, when I returned from high school in the States, an amateur photography buff, I trained my telephoto lens on those little hungry open mouths, trying to identify the Trojan chicks. I wondered then if my grandmother had invented the story as a metaphor. Perhaps she, too, wished she could fly away, just for a while, to escape the relentless duties of family. Instead, she was stuck, nesting on the marble floor in front of her bowl, surrounded by so many little brown hands outstretched. Of the two of my aunts who lived in the house in Madras's Besantnagar neighborhood, my aunt Banu was older than Neela by several years, so she took on the maternal role of enforcer and delouser. It was Banu who enrolled me in St. Michael's, and poor Banu who was called into the head office to meet with Brother, the scowling headmaster who kept admonishing her to rein in her low-performing American niece. It was Banu who locked us together in her room until I mastered my lessons. It was Banu who treated us with the Indian equivalent of RID whenever we kids came back from school scratching our heads like mangy dogs. Once I had both exams and lice. Once again, Banu locked me away. Just beyond her door, I could hear the others laughing and Doordarshan blaring on our TV. The state-run network that was our only channel played clips of songs from Bollywood movies like music videos, all in a row. It was the equivalent of American kids gathering in front of the TV to watch American Bandstand or Soul Train on the weekends. Meanwhile, I was trapped in Banu's room, my head stinging and stinking as she meticulously scraped my scalp to raw dermis with a double-sided fine-tooth comb while simultaneously drilling me on my multiplication tables. Without Banu, I would never have learned the secret of the nines. 9, 18, 27, 36, 45. The digits always add up to 9. Or be able to balance my checkbook. As a kid, I thought I hated Banu. Now I can only hope that I'm able to tame and care for my own daughter the way Banu did me. More concerned with results than our affection, she was totally fine with her status as least favorite aunt. Today I am immensely grateful for what was clearly great love, but back then I resented her for what I saw as unnecessary punishment and arbitrary cruelty, and even worse, for birthing Rajini, the only threat to my supreme reign as house cutie. While Aunt Banu played the role of stern authority figure, Neela, technically my aunt but only 7 years my senior, played my sisterly conspirator. Neela and I were thick as thieves then, and after all these years in health and sickness through kids and divorce, we still are. Rather than medicating my scalp like Banu, Neela braided my hair. Instead of wrestling me into uniforms, Neela dressed me in her colorful hand-me-downs. Neela and I acquired a nickname. Older relatives would often call both of us Alangari, which in Tamil means one who likes to dress up or beautify herself. It was their way of chiding us for not paying the same close attention to our studies as we did to our appearance. We didn't care. When I was really young, around 3, Neela and her cousin Vidya used to dress me as a boy. They even drew a mustache on me with eyebrow pencil. From an early age, I got good at doing makeup. Neela was my first client. A few years later, I started plucking my mother's eyebrows for allowance money. Even today, my mother demands my services whenever I see her, and she still offers me my usual $5 fee. The only thing Neela and I loved more than making each other up was snacking. Near St. Michael's was a stand that sold softball-sized potato-filled samosas, expertly fried and spiced. The samosa, of course, is India's answer to the empanada, or, as the former Lower East Sider in me must admit, the knish. The outside of the samosa, however, is even flakier than those others, made as it is with plenty of ghee or clarified butter. This makes the samosa even worse for you than its doughy Western counterparts, and also even more delicious. Then there were Kachori, another member of the stuffed and fried family. At home, we were more likely to eat aloo tikkis, which are sort of like samosas without the flaky jacket. Aunt Banu was the tikki master of Madras. For my 8th birthday, she deftly formed what seemed like hundreds of potato patties before breading and frying them in a shallow pool of oil. When I had my first McDonald's hash brown, I thought to myself, this is a very poor aloo tikki. Only on special occasions did my family make these types of treats at home, because the process made the entire house smell like frying oil and because they took a houseful of laborers to make. For instance, when we made the crunchy snacks called muruku, the women of my family would gather at Chinnu's house and converge on an old bedsheet in the hall. With oil on our hands, we'd handle the rice and lentil flour dough, simultaneously twisting the dough with our fingers as we form spirals on the sheet. For both the helix created by the twisting and the resulting shape, we called this all-day operation spinning muruku. Then we laid each spiral on a sheet to dry before Banu fried them all. Before we started the spinning, of course, we always molded a knob of dough into a rudimentary figure, dabbed near the head with red vermilion powder, meant to represent Lord Ganesh, the gluttonous god who adored snacking. I'm no expert on the standards and practices of Hinduism, but my guess is that this figure served as a talisman, ensuring that the muruku would turn out well. At home, Neela and I conducted many experiments to clone the pleasure of ampapads. Ampapads are a sort of fruit leather made from mango that can only be found in the north. Though ampapads can be sour, khatta, or sweet, meeta, both Neela and I like the sour ones most. Whenever my beloved Uncle Ravi visited from New Delhi, he'd bring what seemed like suitcases full of ampapads. We'd suck wads of the stuff all day, like ball players would chew, at least until my grandmother or Aunt Banu caught us and insisted we stop, lest we get stomach aches. Our attempts at producing homemade ampapads were destined to fail, of course, because making ampapads at home would be like replicating fruit roll-ups in your kitchen without a dehydrator. Still, we'd smash and press and finally, tired of wasting good fruit, give up, instead simply dousing the fruit with salt, chili powder, and lime juice. Often we'd bring bowls of our concoctions to eat on the veranda, our bare legs splayed on the marble, cold from the shade of the big tree. We also love churan, intensely flavored powders or tiny balls, especially jiragoli, spheres made from ingredients like black salt and cumin, and our favorite, anardana, made from dried pomegranate seeds and spices. There were many kinds of churan, which are mostly used to settle the stomach after a heavy meal. They are bracingly sour and salty, with a touch of sweetness, and so intense they make the sides of your mouth twinge with expectation at first sight, let alone first bite. They are meant to be eaten in small doses, but Neela and I often made whole meals of churan, popping golis into our mouth like raisinettes. Once in a while we burned a wok trying to make our churan, and Jima, Banu, or another matriarch would banish us from the kitchen. You should have told us, they'd say. We would have helped you. You're not getting it, Neela and I thought. This is our party, and you're not invited. To this day, the elder women of my household in Chennai still regard Neela or me with suspicion whenever we enter the kitchen to make anything other than tea. No matter that I host a cooking show or that Neela has raised 2 healthy daughters who clearly haven't starved or been disfigured by a kitchen accident. Of course, we never went long after a reprimand before returning to the kitchen, especially in the quiet of mid-afternoon, when the napping gatekeepers left it unguarded. Like janitors in a lab, we waited out the scientists until we were alone with the chemicals and could tinker. We made many versions of chili cheese toast, a classic Indian snack that today is on every hotel menu in India. The formula for the subcontinental club sandwich is easy. Bread, butter, cheese, and minced green chilies. At the time, we used Britannia brand bread, a knockoff Wonder Bread. The packaging even sported colorful squares instead of circles. which was like a scratchy motel pillow compared with the soft, fluffy down of the real thing. We used Amul brand cheese, I say in quotes, or more accurately, processed cheese-like product, because it had all the quality of Laughing Cow wedges left out too long without the wrapper. But no matter. Decked out with minced chilies or Maggi brand hot and sweet sauce, essentially ketchup and Tabasco swirled into one, the sandwich never disappointed. We cooked it with a sort of pie iron, a contraption with two long wood-covered handles, like those of scissors, which opened and closed the metal encasement. We'd hold a stick of butter like a marker and scribble the fat on the inside of the metal, then close it around the sandwich and hold it over the stovetop flame, turning it until the bread was a crunchy shell for the molten processed goodness inside. On the side, we ate cucumber slices topped with a tart spice mixture called chaat masala. We ate the cucumbers with toothpicks. We thought the toothpicks made us very sophisticated. We also made chocolate milkshakes to go with the sandwiches, which were basically Cadbury drinking chocolate powder swirled into milk. We would hide our small tumblers behind all the food in the fridge, so no one would even know they were there until everyone went to sleep at night. And then we would have our midnight feast. It was hard to get any private time in that house without several generations watching your every move. So our little midnight parties were just for us older kids. No adults. No Rajini or Rohith. Most of all, Neela and I loved the category of snacks called chaat. Chaat comes in such vast variety that only the few qualities every example shares, namely a thrilling mixture of temperatures, textures, like crunchy, crispy, and soft, in all of their own myriad degrees, and flavors, like hot, sweet, tart, and tangy, can provide a meaningful definition. Chaat to me succeeds via culinary chemical principle, the combustion generated by opposites brought together in a bowl. Though things have changed, when I was a kid, no restaurant with four walls and self-respect would sell chaat. The pleasures and thrills offered by chaat were the domain of street vendors, operating out of stalls or pushcarts. The best were composed in front of you, in Delhi. Our beloved chaatwala, near India Gate, made an exceptional version of my favorite, papri chaat, crunchy fried semolina discs dressed with warm chickpeas and boiled potatoes, spiced powder sprinkled on top, like red chili and black cumin salt, and the holy trinity of chaat sauces. Tart, cooling yogurt, bright cilantro and mint green chili chutney, and tangy tamarind date chutney. Those three sauces could create chaat from little else. Potato, crunchy chickpea flour noodles, an exploded samosa, resulting in an elegant hodgepodge, an incredibly complex tasting dish. Whenever I visited Delhi to see my Uncle Ravi, I made him stop for chaat on the way home from the airport, perhaps for pani puri, or golgappa, as it's also called. This meant watching the chaatwala put a miniature sphere of puri, bread that's fried so it puffs up and becomes crunchy, from a pile, poke a hole in its top with his finger, and add a dollop of potatoes, black chickpeas, and tamarind and date chutney inside. Then he dunked the whole thing in pani, meaning water, which looks like swamp water, but is actually a strange and beguiling mix of pureed mint, chili, tamarind, spices, and water. You'd knock it back in one exhilarating bite, and it would explode in your mouth, the cold, crunchy version of a soup dumpling. Nowadays, you're often presented with the components and required to assemble each bite yourself, which is a bit like your favorite chef presenting you with his mise en place of prepped ingredients. Pani puri is never as good as when a master makes it. What Neela and I craved in particular about chaat was the unique flavor that defined and united the array of snacks. We knew this as chaatpati. Think of it as the Indian umami. When a snack combines saltiness, tartness, sweetness, and spiciness in that magical, mouth-smacking proportion, then that snack had chaatpati. At the time, we had no words to describe that sought-after sensation. So when asked to explain, we'd say, you know, as we clicked our tongues against the roofs of our mouths, the sound of satisfaction. For us, chatpati was the condition to which all food should aspire. For me, that's pretty much remained the case my whole life. As a high school student and lapsed vegetarian, I became enamored of the double bacon Western cheeseburger at Carl's Jr. because the combination of salty bacon, creamy melted cheese, and sweet, piquant barbecue sauce amounted to chatpati. Given the crunchy onion ring that topped the patty, I was basically eating a chat burger. When I'd eat my beloved nachos from Green Burrito, I was drawn to the chat-like qualities. There were chips, some crunchy, some soggy, as well as tart, spicy salsas, and cooling dollops of sour cream. Had there been a sweet component, the nachos might have officially reached chatpati status. Even as a young girl, I could tell that the South Indian chutneys we ate on the streets of Chennai were more balanced and round than the jagged-edged northern ones we had eaten in Delhi. We missed their sharpness, and often when we were hungry or bored, we set out to recreate it. Our best sauce to come from all those years of trial and error was our chatpati tamarind date chutney. This dark and gooey sludge became my first mother sauce of sorts, because it instantly woke up any bland or boring ingredient and made it finger-sucking good. When Neela and I cooked, we were as obsessed with reproducing that tang and tingle as we were with replicating Sharmila Tagore's eyeliner in the old Hindi movies we studied. Tagore was a great beauty, a Bengali actress who shot to prominence in art house Satyajit Ray films. She then crossed over successfully into Bollywood and became a major leading lady bombshell. In our favorite movie, called Amar Prem, or Our Love, she plays a courtesan, which we did not even grasp the meaning of then, and her appearance is slightly vulgar, with gaudy jewels, garish saris, and dime-sized bindis on her forehead. This was our ideal. We admired this look the way my daughter lights up at the sight of any article of clothing in Katy Perry pink. Food and fashion were our twin passions, bound together in our feminine Indian identities, even when we were young girls. Back then, eating was also a means of beautification, since the more aloo tikkis and muruka you consumed, the more likely you'd reach a voluptuousness akin to an American size 10 or 12, the required size for looking good in a sari. Indeed, food and femininity were intertwined for me from a very early age. Cooking was the domain of not girls but women. You weren't actually allowed to cook until you mastered the basics of preparing the vegetables and dry roasting and grinding the spices. You only assisted by preparing these mise en place for the older women until you graduated and were finally allowed to stand at the stove for more than boiling tea. Just as the French kitchens had their hierarchy of sous chefs and commis, my grandmother's kitchen also had its own codes. The secrets of the kitchen were revealed to you in stages, on a need-to-know basis, just like the secrets of womanhood. You started wearing bras, you started handling the pressure cooker for lentils. You went from wearing skirts to half saris to wearing full saris. At about the same time, you got to make the rice batter crepes, called dosas, for everyone's tiffin. You did not get told the secret ratio of spices for the house-made sambar curry powder until you came of marriageable age. And to truly have a womanly figure, you had to eat to be voluptuously full of food. This, of course, was in stark contrast to what was considered womanly or desirable in the West, especially when I started modeling. To look good in Western clothes, you had to be extremely thin. Prior to this, I never thought about my weight, except to think that it wasn't ever enough. Then, with modeling, I started depending on my looks to feed myself, though my profession didn't allow me to actually eat very much. When I started hosting food shows, my career went from fashion to food, from not eating to really eating a lot, to put it mildly, Only this time the opposing demands of having to eat all this food and still look good by Western standards of beauty were off the charts. This tug of war was something I would struggle with for most of a decade. Chapter 5. Through the smoke and mirrors of television, my job looks like it's full of glamour and excitement. You'd be forgiven for thinking that all I do is show up in my designer dress, have a meal and a talk, and head home. And it's true, filming the show can be a thrill. Top Chef is a little like live sports. Anything can happen. Plus, there are knives and fire. But TV filming is comically slow. Lulls outnumber activity 10-1. The long days of shooting, some end at midnight, some go even longer, are mostly downtime. But not good downtime, strange downtime. Most of it is spent off the set in my dressing room, a small space overtaken by wardrobe racks. I have a single task during this time, not to mess up my hair, makeup, and clothes. I can't undo all of my glam squad's hard work just because I want to lie down, or have a snack, or God forbid, blow my nose. At all times, I have about 4 people scrutinizing my every movement. In that way, it's a little like spending time with my family. Practically every movement I make requires a conversation. She wants to sit down. Should she keep the dress on? Michelle, my makeup artist, might say. It has a zip, says Albert, my stylist. She should take it off. They talk about me like I'm not there, like 2 parents discussing their kid. My comfy jeans are not typically an option. Albert and Michelle won't allow it. The seams supposedly mark my legs. If Michelle had her way, rollers wouldn't leave my hair until a minute before I'm due on my mark. If Albert had his, I'd never sit down, and even better, would always wear my bathrobe, lest a wrinkle tarnish my dress. Sometimes all I want to do is shut my eyes, but a producer will come around to record lines that might need to be spliced into the show later. I'll get word that I'm finally due back on set, so the producers will send a guy to mic me. But even once we do hustle to the set, we end up hanging around for a while. That's the way it goes during shooting. Hurry up and wait. And often, during that wait, I eat. I eat at judge's table, even though we never eat at judge's table on the show. Not the contestants' food, mind you. Over the years, I've had many snacks on the set that aren't the competition food. In the old days, it started with some innocent sliced apples with peanut butter. Then, in New Orleans, our returning judge, Emeril Lagasse, turned me onto a Thai takeout that brought noodles and coconut milk to the set. And really great Thai po' boys. And even before that, I taught my on-set assistant and Top Chef's unsung hero, Jason, how to make an open-faced version of my childhood classic, the chili cheese toast. This started several years back, long before the hipster restaurant trend to put almost anything on a toasted slice of bread and charge upwards of $12 for it. Back when I was growing up, chili cheese toast was a down-homey snack we made for tea time or when feeling peckish. When you're tired and hungry, you just want something as decadent and rich as what the chefs give you, but without all that fancy stuff. You want something comforting. During shooting, my stomach seems to expand and expect to be fed copious amounts of food even when it doesn't need it. The glacial pace of TV is to blame. On a quickfire day, I try to eat a healthy breakfast. But after hair, makeup, and wardrobe, after getting to the set and going over the script, after the inevitable delays, 6 hours have passed, and I'm ravenous. So when the contestants' food shows up, most of it made in true restaurant style, with more butter than a kilo of croissants, I eat more than I know I should. I probably eat every 2 hours when I'm on the set. Tom will sometimes ask, sipping a gin and tonic, "How can you possibly be hungry?" I tell him I can eat as much as he can drink. I typically go for snacks that won't risk ruining my dress or makeup. You're welcome, Albert and Michelle. Some of the snacks are strange, creations inspired by whatever I spot in the fridge. Some of them become regulars in my rotation, like my latest pet concoction, cottage cheese doused in Cholula hot sauce. Sometimes I'll dunk chips or celery in it, like a dietetic version of ranch dip. I'm always trying to recreate some vaguely healthy version of junk food. You've got to have junk food. You've got to feel satisfied while still somehow keeping your waistline in check. This is the constant struggle that pervades my life. How do I look good and still be good at my job? How do I experience enough food so I know what I'm talking about on TV in the midst of these culinary heavyweights and still look good while talking about it? The men on the show have it easy, in part because men on TV have uniforms. There's the jacket in black, blue, or gray. There's the shirt, the pants. I can never tell whether Tom is gaining or losing weight beneath his boxy suits. He always looks the same to me. Tom also has the benefit of being Tom, a decorated veteran of the restaurant kitchen. Like so many chefs, he is practiced at the taste of this, taste of that eating regimen. I'm the one who has to look like a glorified weather girl, with form-fitting dresses and all, which, don't get me wrong, I love, at least until I don't. Unlike the other judges who aren't there for the beginning two acts of the show, I have to gorge during the appetizer portion of the Top Chef episode meal. The quickfire. We're not a live show, but we sometimes function as one. We can't shoot and reshoot. Juicy ribeye steaks turn into cold meat and congealing fat. So the reality of the quickfire is virtually identical to the way it appears on TV. Contestants are given a challenge on the spot, like making a mousse bouche using only products found in a vending machine, or reinvent the po'boy sandwich, and forced to execute a dish without forethought or mise en place. The chefs must act on a combination of culinary instinct and creative impulse. Adrenaline shakes awake their true selves, and the food they produce reveals who they really are as cooks. I always come hungry. They deserve the full audience of my appetite. I stand with the episode's special guest, typically an established and celebrated chef, in front of a contestant and her dish. We eat, then we walk out of the frame. The cameras do a two-step around us, and we walk back into frame in front of another contestant. The process is rapid-fire. Bite, bite, bite. Pause. Adopt inscrutable facial expression. Spew a vague comment that gives nothing away. And repeat. After a while, my stomach begins to feel like a restaurant dumpster. It was this kind of experience that made me devise a drink I call Cranberry Drano. I came up with it to help cleanse my digestive pipes after all the gluttonous eating on the show. During production, I'm likely to consume 3 full glasses of this potion a day, scrunching up my face the whole time due to its less than pleasurable taste. But in spite of the taste, it does get me through to the other side of filming. During the Chicago season, the immoderation started with the very first quickfire. The guest judge was Rocco Dispirito, and this being Chicago, the contestants, all 16 of them, were tasked with making deep dish pizzas that showed off their culinary personalities. In other words, the already brawny deep dishes were decked out with prosciutto and lamb sausage and duck, with oozy taleggio and cream-filled burrata. In the interest of fairness, Rocco and I had to sample each one straight from the oven, and then, again, later, to see how it held up to delivery. Do the math. 32 tastes, several bites in each. And you can't take a small bite of deep dish pizza. You cut off a bite with short length and width, but the height is fixed at, well, deep. I was in physical pain, devastated by my fullness. By the filming of the second episode of the Chicago season, Darshan, my wardrobe diva at the time, noticed that my dress was tight. By the time the Chicago season wrapped, I had gained 17 pounds. I felt horrible that I couldn't manage my job and my appearance. My divorce had just become final. I was living in hotels and had little control over what I ate, even when I wasn't filming. That July, when I first moved into the Surrey, I had had the opposite problem. People wondered if I was possibly anorexic, because I couldn't eat from depression and was so very thin. Mere months later, in November, after my divorce became final, and I had filmed another season of Top Chef, I ballooned up 2 dress sizes. Every woman has a record of her body, a closet full of jeans and bras in various sizes, albums full of photographs revealing periods of weight gain and loss. I've also come to realize that as a 40-something woman on TV, I'm a rapidly depreciating asset, like a car just driven off the lot. Then there's the added indignity of seeing my flaws dissected, zoomed in on, and gleefully mocked. I've come to accept my weight gain as part of my Top Chef pact with the devil. But early on, I was in denial. To make sure we came in under budget, I used to suggest that we borrow clothes from designers. This is a common strategy for models and actresses, which gives onlookers the impression that they have bottomless closets. Darshan had to break it to me. To fit into clothes available for borrowing, I had to be a sample size. In other words, waif-like. I wasn't. By now, everyone on the set is used to my fluctuations. My beauty crew always finds a way to patch me up. From the start, Darshan would gather dresses in several sizes. She knew I'd jump up 2 or 3 sizes during filming. That, along with the magic of the camera, careful angling and long shots, helps hide the inevitable stomach paunch and back of the arm pudge that always appear a few weeks in. When I wasn't filming, I could control my weight fairly well through good eating habits and exercise, thanks to both a forgiving metabolism and a flexible schedule. What I could never control, however, was my skin. I hated the fact that my dark skin marked and mottled easily, from my mosquito bite scarred legs to the 2 pale circles on my left arm from the olden days of inoculations in India, to the scar on my right arm. I didn't love that my coloring set off the stretch marks behind my knees, which appeared during a teenage growth spurt, or those on my backside, acquired from my many weight fluctuations. Various cuts and burns from cooking still remained too, faded, but nonetheless a reminder of every time I made some mistake. Every injury or physical skirmish left its mark on the landscape of my body. Yet what I truly disliked, in certain gloomy moments, and not always consciously, was my skin color itself, of which all that other piffle was merely a reminder. The insidious reasons for a brown girl's self-loathing won't be surprising to any woman of color. I cannot rightly compare my own struggles to those of any other minority, as each ethnicity comes with its own baggage. And my South Asian experience is just one variation on the experience of dark-skinned people everywhere. As parents and grandparents often do in Asian countries, my extended family urged me to avoid the sun. Not out of fear that heat stroke would sicken me or that UV rays would lead to cancer, but more, I think, out of fear that my skin would darken to the shade of an untouchable, a person from the lowest caste in Indian society, someone who toils in the fields. The judgments implicit in these exhortations and what they mean about your worth might not dawn on you while you're playing cricket in the sand. What's at stake might not dawn on you while as a girl you clutch fast to yourself, your blonde-haired, blue-eyed doll named Helen. But all along, the message that lighter skin is equivalent to a more attractive, worthier self is getting beamed deep into your subconscious. Western ideals of beauty don't stop at ocean shores. They pervade the world and mingle with those of your own country to create mutant, unachievable standards. The prizing of lighter skin did not reach our shores with colonialism either, for there is much reference to the virtues of fair skin in ancient Indian texts. The logic of the lighter the better comforts you until suddenly you are the darker one. Our attitudes towards skin color are manifold and nuanced, and even contradictory. Kids who didn't think twice about calling me Blackie in high school were still quite capable of smearing suntan oil on themselves and lying out for incessant hours to get a tan. When I came to the U.S., of course, I saw people in many shades. It was strange and wonderful to see Chinese and Caucasian and Dominican people all riding the same subway. I was fascinated by all the types of people, not only by their skin colors and hair textures, but also by the many different ways in which they dressed and expressed themselves. It was exciting to be a kid in New York City. Over time, I started to realize, however, that certain groups of people were viewed differently than others. It was confusing. The discrimination and racism faced by African Americans was obvious to me, even as a young child. I wasn't black, but my own brown skin seemed to come with stories I hadn't written myself. During the next decade and a half, I'd gradually learn that to many Americans, my skin color signaled third-world slums as seen in Indiana Jones movies, malaria, hot curry and, quote, stinky food, and strange bright clothing, a caricature of India and Indians. I began to change into a person who contained two people within herself, a girl proud of and connected to her culture and native country, and one who wished she just looked like her old doll Helen. By high school, when fitting in seems almost as important as breathing, that second girl began to take control. When I changed my name from Padma to Angelique for approximately 4 wince-worthy years, I was trying to hide from my identity. That would come later, once we had moved to California. But my divided self began to split in New York, after the second reunion with my mother. When I returned to finish fourth grade at PS 158, I joined my mother in Manhattan at 504 East 81st Street, down the street from Mr. Chip's Coffee Shop and Touch of Class Cleaners, just 2 blocks from where we had started our life in America. I had a ball going to import stores like Azuma in the Village to decorate our new bachelorette pad, a studio apartment we divided with a yellow curtain to hide our bed. My mother's heart must have been broken and aching at her second failed marriage, but she didn't stop whatever activity was in progress to show it. My mother had a way of making every task a more elaborate happening than it needed to be. She loved the ritual of things. Far from her own culture and ripped away time and again from her family, she ardently made every shopping trip an excursion, every grocery run a treasure hunt, every unexpected visit by a family member an impromptu dinner party. She had the charming but exhausting habit of conceiving and cooking literally a dozen different dishes for each of these visits, all out of her tiny kitchen with no window. Our friends and family took to dropping in on us without warning so as not to impose on the already tiring schedule of a single mom working by day and studying for a graduate degree by night. I don't know when Mother found all the hours to do all of it, but she did, willingly and with a smile. She relished planning a menu in bed late at night before a gathering. I thought she was talking to me, but mostly she was talking aloud to herself about what spices she would use, concocting new chutneys in her head, rehearsing new experiments using funny American ingredients like cream of wheat or pasta shells with South Asian spices and vegetables. She sniffed out rare Asian flora like fresh coriander and sugarcane, not at all found easily on the northeastern coast of America in the late 1970s. The experiments were always wildly pungent, and mostly all delicious. Our neighbors, stay-at-home mothers from down the hall, often offered me bologna and cheese sandwiches with something like misty, righteous pity glimmering in their eyes. But I loved my mother's cooking. I didn't eat ham yet, or whatever that mystery meat was, and I liked watching her, not only in the kitchen. She was incredibly glamorous. Once she shed her nurse's uniform, she was liberated and instantly transformed. She got dressed to go out, spraying Norelle perfume into her décolletage, trying to obscure the lingering aroma of cumin left in her cleavage from cooking my dinner. She wore heavy eye makeup with robin's egg blue eyeshadow, rouge and bright lipstick, the whole 9 yards in the brightest colors. She had taken makeup lessons from an aging, striking Swedish model who ran them out of her house. I watched the Dukes of Hazzard with the model's son in his bedroom, while out in their living room, the women practiced on each other. I still remember the view over the city from their high-rise apartment. Our only windows looked out onto another building's wall. I couldn't wait for her to leave after those nights of self-adornment so I could climb onto the sink, open the medicine cabinet, and use all the tempting colors with abandon on my own face. Like a harlequin at the circus, I drew big, deep semicircles for eyebrows, coloring under them with blue eyeshadow. I often fell asleep like that, streaking the sheets with her grease paint. She never got mad, though, not once. My mother even paid me to do chores and groom her. I got $5 for plucking her eyebrows, a raise from my starting pay of $3, and I got a buck for vacuuming, since our place was quite small. I would buy vegetables at Finest Grocery Store on York on my way home from school, and I could make an extra couple bucks if I washed the produce and broke off the ends of beans. I don't know how she afforded to live in the city on her nurse's salary and do all the things we miraculously did. After a year in our cozy little studio, when my mom finally disentangled herself legally from V, my stepdad, we moved to California. Another new beginning. My mother tried to convince me I'd be happier in our new apartment, where for the first time in my life, I would have my own room. I would even have my own shelf in the kitchen for my beloved Pringles. But I was angry at her for moving us out of New York, and never really forgave her until I was well into my 20s, shelf of Pringles notwithstanding. My mother must have been tired. Her feet and heart must have ached from the tap dancing and rebuilding and continual starting over. She hated the New York winters. A little girl is a wonderful source of joy and love, and even comfort to any mother. But I look back now and realize how lonely she must have been. How alone, without any support or anyone to talk to, in bed or elsewhere, other than me. We were extremely close. But as a child, I had no sense of what she might have needed as an adult. When we first arrived, we spent the summer in the city of Orange, near Disneyland, on the pull-out couch of the family room in my Uncle Barrett's house. After that, we moved to a two-bedroom rental in Arcadia, about 15 miles northeast of L.A. Every day, my mom rode the bus for 20 minutes from Arcadia to City of Hope, the hospital where she worked. She hadn't yet learned to drive. While the apartment itself felt almost palatial compared to our studio on the Upper East Side, I was put off by the calm and quiet of my new home. I'd always lived in a metropolis. First it was Delhi, then Madras or Chennai, then New York. Now I felt burdened by the lack of bustle, the empty sidewalks, and the looming San Gabriel Mountains. I missed Gracie Mansion and the East River, which to me at the time had the romance of the Seine. In New York, I had had a measure of real independence. If I was hungry, I could stroll down the block and get a bagel and cream cheese at the Jewish deli. I could grab an after-school slice and soda for $1 at the pizzeria. I could roller skate alone the 11 blocks south to Sloan Kettering and meet my mother at work. I felt like a person, albeit a small one. In Arcadia, however, I felt like a kid. I had to rely on my mom for almost everything. And Arcadia was strange and foreign to me in another equally isolating way. It was populated mostly by white people, and a small smattering of Asians, Koreans, Chinese, and Filipinos. Other than my mother and my reflection in the mirror, I effectively saw just one other Indian, my uncle. He was married to my Aunt Trudy, a Swiss woman, so their kids, Sheila and Ashok, were half Indian, half Swiss ethnically, but otherwise pretty much brown-skinned American kids from Orange County, California. They didn't identify with many things in Indian culture and only went to India once every few years. But because they were used to frequent visits from strange relatives of their fathers from back home, they were incredibly nice and welcoming. My cousin Ashok was a year older than me and his sister Sheila 6 years younger. But the three of us were close and played well together. At some point, my mother befriended a Gujarati couple, the Mishras. Pratima Mishra was an expert at assimilating non-Indian ingredients into her cooking. Often she would deep-fry whatever she found, say flour tortillas cut into triangles, and serve them with the chutney. India, of course, was a sea of brown faces, And in New York, Indians had been everywhere, from the subcontinenters who colonized our Elmhurst apartment building to the cab drivers who knew the quickest way to get anywhere in the city, to the doctors who worked with my mom at Sloan Kettering, to the hot dog vendors who had sold us our hot dogless dogs. In New York, I even heard many Indian languages spoken, including Tamil. I never felt like an outsider. Or, at least when I did, I knew I was in the company of many, many other outsiders. On the walk to school, whether it was in Elmhurst or on York Avenue in Manhattan, I'd pass Filipinos and Peruvians, Barbadians and Chinese, Puerto Ricans and African Americans and Middle Easterners. Even some of the white faces I saw were minorities, I learned, because they were Polish or had menorahs instead of Christmas trees. We were different from one another. We spoke different languages, ate different foods, went home to see our families in different far-flung countries. But we were alike in our differences. In that respect, New York City didn't feel that much different from India. Just as Chennai and Delhi included people from all over India with different languages, religions, and cultures, so too did New York, where everyone seemed united by place and shared purpose, different from one another, but part of a larger sameness. California, and especially the greater Los Angeles area, is incredibly diverse, but the vast sprawl meant that the great pockets of Mexican and Chinese and African American inhabitants, at least from my vantage point, stayed separate. In high school, I observed this in microcosm. The Filipinos hung out together, so did the Mexicans. At school, kids didn't know what to make of me. They were confused that I didn't speak Spanish. "But you look Mexican," they'd say. The types of insults and treatment I got used to in elementary school came fast and furious here too, though they were less creative than black giraffe. I was taller and ganglier than most kids in my fifth grade class. At age 10, my being tall seemed intentional, like an affront. You could almost see the contempt on the other kids' faces. "Who does she think she is, taking up all that space?" I imagine them thinking. My vocabulary, nothing special but distasteful to those who felt that trying at school was an offense almost as grave as being tall, led the kids to call me dictionary behind my back. Becky liked to yank my hair from behind me in English class. David stuck to giving me flat tires by stepping on my heels as we walked to class, making me struggle to get my shoes back on, and frequently called me the N-word in my sixth grade class. I got egged in seventh grade on the last day of school. I was punched by a girl in the face, then an egg was smashed on top of my head. I remember banging on my seventh grade teacher, Mr. Pila's, classroom door, dripping with yolk and gooey ooze all in my hair, pleading for him to let me in and save me. I was bullied and humiliated and relieved that school was over and we were moving. We only lived a couple of years in that mostly white enclave of Arcadia, then moved to a more working-class neighborhood in another part of the valley where my mom and her boyfriend could afford to buy a house. In eighth grade at Sierra Vista Junior High in La Puente, I became perhaps the world's least popular cheerleader. I suspect that the teachers, who liked me because I worked hard, ensured that I made the squad. The rest of the girls definitely did not approve. For the first time in my life, even after a childhood spent shuttling between New York and India, I felt foreign. I felt like I didn't belong. To make matters worse, this was around the time I met Peter. We had only been in Los Angeles for 2 years. I was still in sixth grade, living in our apartment in Arcadia, when I came out of my room one morning to the sight of a man snoring loudly on the divan in a big, dark heap. He had greasy hair and skin the color of mahogany leather. A beer belly leaked out of the space between his tattered T-shirt and paint-speckled jeans. I was scared of this man, of his big, knotty, calloused hands, of his smell, sour like old beer and tobacco. 2 years later, he would become my new stepfather. "Mom," I yelled, "who is this man?" She explained that she had hired him, a friend of a friend, to build us a stereo cabinet. For some reason, he had decided to show up at 6 a.m., on a Saturday, too early for hammering. She told him so and suggested he lie down for a while. When the sleeping giant awoke, he clomped around in his work boots and spoke to my mother in base, tortured Hindi. My preteen self immediately hated him. Born and raised in Fiji, Peter descended from generations of low-caste Indians whom the British shipped as indentured laborers to colonies like Fiji and Guyana with the promise of a better life. He immigrated to California directly from Fiji, working first as a gardener. Historically, those Indian